This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
We are now advancing rulemaking in one of the most significant areas of global trade, and that is e-commerce and digital trade. What we're talking about here is a hugely significant initiative for the world trading system. The new set of global trade rules on digital trade, e-commerce, which will supercharge the development of the digital economy.
For over 25 years, the World Trade Organization, an intergovernmental organization based in Geneva, Switzerland, that regulates and facilitates international trade, has grappled with how to engage with e-commerce. What started as a moratorium on e-commerce customs duties has expanded into the development of a new agreement, which touches on a wide range of issues, including privacy, data localization, and electronic contracting. The new deal has been heralded by some as a game changer, but some aren't fully convinced that it actually does break new ground. Patrick LeBlond is a University of Ottawa professor in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, where he specializes in economic governance and policy with a focus on North America, Europe, and increasingly China. He joins me on the podcast to talk about the latest WTO developments and assess the potential impact of its new e-commerce agreement. Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. You know, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and e-commerce doesn't typically attract a ton of attention outside, I guess, of certain circles. The extent to which these kinds of rules gender public attention, it tends to be the domestic side, you know, legislation in Canada like C-11 and C-18, the EU AI Act, some of the regulatory proposals in the US are usually the point of focus. Those aren't all e-commerce, of course, but sort of broadly digital policy. To the extent to which people are thinking about trade and e-commerce, it's usually about trade agreements, the USMCA or CUSMA from a Canadian perspective, for example. But for many years now, the WTO has been working to establish a global consensus, especially with respect to some of the e-commerce rules. Some recent developments suggest there's been a breakthrough, but you're a bit more skeptical just about how important that breakthrough is, or at least how consequential it is. Why don't we start with some of the background, notably the e-commerce customs moratorium, which has been a focal point for many years. What is it, and how did it provide really the trigger to re-examine some of the global rules around e-commerce?
The moratorium on customs duties on electronic transmissions is something that the WTO members agreed to back in 1998. And if, you know, for those who are old enough will remember, that's kind of when e-commerce was taking off, right? A lot of the companies that we take for granted today, the Amazons, the Googles, even Apple to some extent, we're just kind of starting, or in Apple's case, restarting. There was a realization that ordering stuff online was going to be the future. And there were fears that member states of the WTO would kind of impose tariffs or taxes on these transmissions as a way to generate revenues, or obviously for just pure protectionism, to protect maybe their own e-commerce companies or firms doing business domestically, and avoid the potentially big American firms taking over. So there were real concerns there. So that there was a moratorium that was agreed as part of a bigger, kind of somewhat larger agreement, basically to do nothing and see how things would evolve, right? Because it was all new. The internet was relatively new. Everyone was trying to figure out how this would work. So the best thing that they came up with was just to do no harm. And I think that was the right approach back then. But obviously, over time, not only did the digital economy and digital trade take off, we started in a way consuming more and more stuff digitally, whether it's movies or music, social media, advertising, all these things, newspapers, magazines, right? These things that, who reads things on paper nowadays? Well, maybe old people like me. But otherwise, yeah, the world has certainly changed. And there was a you know, countries started, feeling the pressure to regulate this activity, whether it's to protect, you know, personal data, protect privacy, maybe to have, you know, cybersecurity regulations to make sure that, you know, again, people's data or computers or whatever are protected, and the same for businesses. So the realization that it's not just about the flow of data per se, but it's also about kind of everything in the content and having a trustworthy environment. And we started seeing e-commerce or digital trade chapters appearing in so-called free trade agreements, right? It started with the first there was the Canada European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, where it reaffirmed the moratorium, where there was clauses where there would be more kind of regulatory cooperation and exchange of information between Canada and the EU. Then we saw broader provisions, more provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and then in the Canada United States Mexico Agreement. So we started seeing kind of these regional or bilateral agreements having these provisions. But then there was the question, okay, well, what about those countries that are not part of this, right? Kind of the rest of the world. So attempts were started in 2017 come up with a broader plurilateral agreement that eventually might be integrated into WTO, if not as a kind of a standalone. That would involve a lot more countries than just those that are part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or, you know, North American countries, or Canada and the European Union. So that's really how the negotiations beyond the sort of do no harm maintenance with the moratorium came along, to say, okay, well, maybe we could now take those provisions that we find in these bilateral or regional agreements and have them apply more broadly at the World Trade Organization.
Okay, so we see that emerging from a trade perspective globally, and that more expansive approach. Could we close the book on the moratorium itself? Because I know that we started to see some opposition come from at least a couple of countries in the developing world. And so this continual attempt to renew that moratorium every couple of years suddenly started to become far more contentious.
Yes. So yes, the moratorium has been extended every 2 years or so at the ministerial conference of the WTO. And then over time, some member states, as they kind of developed their own, in a way, digital economy and capacity, started questioning whether, you know, it made sense nowadays, if, you know, the sort of the economy is moving, is becoming much more digital in nature. Well, then does that mean, is there, that is a source of revenue, and some countries, you know, and especially India and South Africa, who are not known as kind of liberal free trading countries, they're very reticent to negotiate so-called free trade agreements, started challenging and threatening to veto the renewal of the moratorium. Because they felt that it was not advantageous to them, and that they might want actually to impose taxes or duties on electronic transmissions. So, and it came to a head almost this year's ministerial conference, where the Secretary General said, "Well, this looks like it's going to be the last time we are able to do this. You know, we don't expect to see a renewal of the moratorium at the next ministerial conference in 2026. So obviously that scares a lot of people. For business, it would be just another headache and additional costs, in addition to all the various regulations that they have to satisfy when it comes to digital trade. So this new agreement potentially would provide reassurance that this would not happen, and the prohibition on duties on electronic transmissions would actually continue into the future, which is ultimately what business wants. and many governments want in a way to support business and the cross-border digital trade.
So on the one hand, we've got that growing backlash or lack of consensus, I guess, when it comes to the customs moratorium, and that may have reached its endpoint or is about to reach its endpoint within the next couple of years. But as you mentioned, this really does spark at the same time a separate path from those that not only want to see a continued consensus on a customs moratorium, but are looking really for far more.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it started out where with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the United States, which were at the forefront of that negotiation, only to pull out once Donald Trump became president, they inserted or insisted on a chapter in that agreement that would cover a lot of ground, you know, including, first of all, the moratorium, to say that, you know, all the now CPTPP members would not impose any tariffs on electronic transmissions among, you know, against each other. There was also provisions on the free flow of data, provisions on, making sure that there are regulations to protect privacy and cybersecurity. But ultimately, it was to say, well, you know, you have to have an environment where data is free to flow. You know, digital trade is free to happen. There's no tariffs. And, you know, we call on the members to have certain types of regulations to protect privacy and protect data. But ultimately, you know, the trade or digital trade for business purposes should happen. And for the rest, well, we should certainly cooperate to kind of maintain that kind of safe and trustworthy environment. So that happened in the CPTPP. Then it was kind of similar, but went a bit even further within the Canada-US Mexico Free Trade Agreement, so NAFTA's NAFTA 2.0. But obviously, these concerned only a small number of countries around the world. So there was, you know, at the same time, the realization that, you know, free trade or digital trade was happening. There was more and more cross-border trade of a digital nature. And, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have a much broader agreement? So negotiations started in 2017, you know, the so-called Joint Statement Initiative within the WTO, where it started with about 60 countries and went up to about 80 countries, negotiating an agreement on electronic commerce that in a way would draw a lot of inspiration from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and then the Canada-US Mexico agreement. And also once China joined in 2019, kind of provisions that we saw in the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is a broader Asian agreement. I'm not sure we could call it a free trade agreement, but certainly a trade agreement that aims to foster more trade within Asia, and of which China is a part of. So, and then so over time, negotiations happened. You had at the beginning kind of the U.S. pushing for, you know, basically free trade when it comes to digital trade, when it comes to electronic commerce, when it comes to free data flows. And then on the other hand, you had countries like China, but not only China, saying, well, no, we want to keep a kind of general exception for what is called the legitimate public policy objective, and also for national security. As we know, as I mentioned, China has a very strictly regulated online world, and so obviously it didn't want an international agreement that could upset that. So they were working kind of to weaken language, whereas the Americans were working to a very strong kind of free trade type language in that agreement. And for the longest time, kind of things evolved very slowly, with both sides in parallel kind of being in there and hoping to make headway. But ultimately, an agreement was found this year. And something that is because of a reversal from the United States in terms of its position, where the Biden administration all of a sudden decided that you know what? We think that regulating the digital economy is actually very important, and now we need to find more of a balance. And therefore, we're not as keen on this kind of free flow of data and free flow of digital trade. So they decided to pull a lot of the provisions that they had insisted on, which ultimately, in my mind, is what made the, an agreement at the WTO possible.
Okay, that's interesting. So it's data that were some of the major issues. Can you talk a bit about what some of the barriers were, and that'll kind of help inform what the agreement ultimately looks like?
Well, when we talk about, you know, data flows, and a lot of it, obviously, if data can't flow, then, you know, it's very difficult for trade, digital trade to happen, right? So if it's you're trying to order a good online, but, you know, and where you provide, let's say, personal information, but all of a sudden, the country where you're based or the country that that's receiving the order says, no, that data is not, you know, can be shipped or can be received, well, then your order is not going to happen. Or if, you know, you're wanting to see a movie or music or something that, that is of a digital nature. And again, that's, you know, it ultimately it's in data form. So any barriers to that are a problem. Another way that governments seem to kind of protect their data flows is by force kind of obligating businesses to locate whatever data that they have on servers and computing equipment in the territory where they are doing business. So that's often the case for anything that has to do with governments for security purposes. But, you know, China does this where, you know, any data that Chinese businesses, whether they're domestic or national, operating in China, all that data has to sit on a server located in China, often half owned by a Chinese company. And the Chinese government says, you know, we want to have access to that data just for security's you know, security reasons. And if you want to take that data out of the country, well, you need to ask for permission. So that's obviously a very extreme version. But these kind of data localization requirements are, in a way, a form of protectionism. The argument is that it's for national security or protecting, you know, the privacy of person or of people, their personal information. But at the same time, it does mean that it can be difficult for smaller businesses to operate internationally if they can't afford or if they have to pay extra funds to have their data located in various places, right? So the U.S. was really adamant that those types of restrictions should not happen to any people who sign on a trade agreement involving digital trade, whether it's the CPTPP or the USMCA, those types of agreements, and including WTO. And now, in the fall of 2023, surprising pretty much everyone, the United States Trade Representative decided that, you know what, we're changing tack. It's okay if you want to do data localization. It's okay if you want to have very restrictive data protection or personal, you know, privacy protection at home, even if it limits what can be done or if it raises the cost of digital trade, because we think that that's now more important to regulate the digital economy. And certainly this is what we think we want to do in the US. So therefore, we're no longer insisting on removing all these types of barriers to the movement of data across borders. So in a way, they kind of changed tact and almost agreed with the Chinese position that, you know, basically countries should decide on their own what kind of what level and what kind of regulations on data flows and digital trade more broadly they should impose, undermining obviously these international trade agreements.
Right. Okay. So data, a major issue, and that big change in the U.S. position, as you mentioned last year. So there is now the outlines of an agreement. What are some of the key provisions that it does contain in terms of either that issue or more broadly, what are the core provisions that would lead some to hail this as a historic agreement?
Right. Well, I think, you know, first of all, the fact that there is an agreement for many, that makes it historic. And certainly notable. As we know, it's been very difficult to agree to much at the World Trade Organization. So for some, just the fact that, you know, 80 countries or so agreed on such an international deal is something to celebrate. Now, in terms of its actual content, I mean, the agreement, again, from my reading of it, is kind of underlines the current situation, right? It kind of underlines the status quo of where we are. One benefit is that it kind of tries to lock in the moratorium on customs duties on electronic transmissions. So it says that, you know, for the first 5 years, the prohibition on imposing any duties on electronic transmission would be in place. Then after 5 years, there's a review process. One of the big questions, obviously, is how does that work? Does it mean that the moratorium continues to apply until all the member states decide that it doesn't? Or is it the other way around, that all the members to the agreement have to agree to keep it going? So that's a bit of a question mark. The language in the agreement seems to suggest that it's more that it keeps applying unless all the members decide that it doesn't. So that's the way, again, my reading of the agreement, which would be good news. In a way, that makes the burden much more difficult to impose any duties going forward, which sort of enshrines the moratorium. So that's certainly probably the thing that people are most concerned about, is the fact that countries would be free to impose any duties. Although in this case, that means that it would only be those signatories to the agreement who would not be able to impose duties on themselves. They could all obviously impose duties on countries that are not part of the agreement, at least to some extent. And there's always the question of whether they could do so legally. That remains to be seen. The rest, interestingly enough, the agreement basically has no provisions on the free flow of data. So all the provisions that the Americans were insisting on for many, many years that we find in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that we find in the Canada-US-Mexico Agreement, are gone. So in that sense, basically now it says that, okay, you're free to regulate as long as you kind of allow ways that are non-discriminatory for businesses to flow data across borders. Regulations are fine as long as they're non-discriminatory, and still there are ways where data could flow, and like through certification agreements or like the way the European Union does it, which is to say, oh no, okay, yes, we kind of mutual recognition. We recognize that your data protection or privacy protection regime is good enough. So yes, we can flow data to you. But you know, ultimately, it does put a barrier at the beginning to flow data. For the rest, the agreement is very much aspirational. A lot of it is focused on the fact that members should have regulatory regimes in place to protect data, to protect privacy, for cybersecurity, to protect consumers, you know, to facilitate electronic payments, to facilitate electronic documentations, those kinds of things. But they're all kind of encouraging the member states, the members of the agreement, to do those things. They're not obligatory. They don't say, you know, you shall do this. It's more like, we encourage you to do this, or the members commit to doing this. So in that sense, it's much more aspirational. Whether it will really kind of change things, that's a big question. I mean, so far, similar language exists in the CPTPP and the CUSMA or USMCA. And, you know, we have not seen, at least again, from my perspective, I have not seen a lot of action in terms of regulatory cooperation with regards to digital trade aspects.
Okay. I want to come to some of your comments on this agreement, but first, where's Canada in all of this? Of course, my podcast often is very Canadian focused in terms of digital policy, and we've managed to spend quite a lot of time talking about this issue. Canada's surely part of this, but you haven't really mentioned that. Does Canada have any particular position or been publicly involved in any significant way as part of all these discussions?
Not Very publicly. I mean, Canada certainly supported and has been part of the negotiations of this agreement at the WTO, although it has not come out in favor of one position or the other. I think, you know, overall, it's followed the United States position, you know, in a way, because that's kind of the commitments we've undertaken with the Americans. So it would have been a bit weird to say, yes, we've committed, you know, to all these provisions in the CUSMA or even before in the CPTPP, and now we would actually diverge from the United States. So up until basically last October, the Canada was following the U.S., and then the U.S. did a, you know, their kind of 180 degree turn, and Canada didn't really say anything and just kind of went along. So again, is it the feeling is that, well, you know, Canada is just happy to be part of the agreement, and but ultimately, does it really change much for Canada? Probably not, because, you know, we have our deal with the Americans. We have the deal with the CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We have, you know, the agreement with the European Union, where, because our, you know, privacy regime is still thankfully recognized as being equivalent, we can flow data back and forth between the EU, personal data back and forth between the EU and Canada. So in a way, the stakes for Canada were probably quite low in terms of the WTO negotiations, you know, and certainly Canada did not take any leadership position during those negotiations, as far as we can tell.
Okay, so other agreements of greater significance, at least from a Canadian economic perspective. Now, notwithstanding talks of a historic deal, that's how some have tried to frame it, you've suggested that this isn't really a game changer. I think we've had a few hints as to why, but can you talk a bit about why this may not be all it's cracked up to be in terms of something truly historic?
Well, I think other than saying that, oh, there was an agreement, and obviously some say, well, it's something that can, you know, that we can build on. Overall, just having an agreement that, you know, rehashes more or less existing provisions in other agreements doesn't really, you know, in a way, it feels very much like the lowest common denominator. The fact that it allows countries to pretty much, you know, regulate their digital economy and digital trade in the way that they want without any real repercussions, just because they can claim that, well, they're pursuing a legitimate public policy objective, which, you know, everyone is, whether it's to protect consumers, whether it's to protect data, whether it's to protect national security. Ultimately, it's an agreement that lacks teeth, other than for the customs duties moratorium, which there you might say, if obviously this agreement ever comes into force, which is not a done deal, then it would provide stability when it comes to those things for those 80 plus members. So that's the good part. Although, you know, potentially, you know, we, even if there were calls that the custom duties moratorium was not maybe going to be renewed in 2 years' time, there's still the possibility that it would have, right? Every 2 years, it seems to be, oh, this time is not going to happen. And then it happens. So, you know, that's why it's difficult to say that this agreement is really a game changer, in the sense that it, you know, provides new language. It obliges the member states, the states members to this, members to this agreement, or the, you know, eventual signatories, to really kind of commit to facilitating international digital trade. It's, as I said, it's very aspirational, and, you know, it kind of says, yeah, we should do this, we want to do this, but whether we're actually going to do it is a big question. So whether from a business perspective it provides any certainty and removes barriers to trade, to digital trade, to me, I just don't see it in the language of the agreement. As I said, other than the moratorium, where you have 5 years of peace in a way, and then potentially the language suggests that it could go on for longer, I don't see much in there, especially if data flows. There can be restrictions on data flows. There can be any types of kind of regulations on the digital economy within countries. I'm not sure that it changes much for business compared to the current situation, honestly.
Okay. Now, you've hinted at this as well, but what comes next? So they've reached an agreement. What needs to happen in order to have this agreement take effect? And then you've made reference to this 5 years. Can you talk a bit about what the timelines look like if this does take effect?
Right. Well, that's, right now the there are two ways that are being discussed. One is, and that seems to be what a lot of the signatories would want, is to have this agreement incorporated into the WTO body of law. And whether how this can be done is a matter of kind of discussions among legal scholars. Or if not, and of course, if that happens, it would require all the WTO members to agree to that. So one member, one WTO members could actually veto the whole thing. So that's a big question mark as to whether it can be done. If that can be done, the alternative is for the 80 or so current signatories of this what's so-called stabilized text, right? So it's basically we finally agreed on a text. Now the question is, where does that text end up? Is it part of the WTO body of law, or is it a standalone agreement, so a plurilateral agreement among the members? And in this case, obviously, they would have to ratify the agreement one by one within, their domestic legal framework. And that obviously could take time to happen. So in the meantime, there's always a possibility that this agreement may not be in effect by the next ministerial conference in 2026. So then we'd have to see what's going to happen to the moratorium. So, there is a deal on the table, but, whether that deal is actually going to come into effect and then which countries would be part of it, that is a big question, especially if there is a change of in the White House with a new Trump administration that certainly doesn't see the WTO in a very good light. So maybe it's something that the new Trump administration would just not care about. Right now we don't know. Certainly not something that's very high on their radar, I would think.
Okay. So still some real question marks. You mentioned that Canada hasn't played a significant role. They're part of it, but in some ways there are other agreements that are bigger priorities. Why don't we close with this? What should Canada be doing if it's not the WTO and we've got this existing agreement, of course, with the United States, which could be open to renegotiation in a couple of years, but there are more cutting edge digital economy, e-commerce type agreements out there, most notably the DEPA, the Digital Economy Partnership Agreement. Should Canada be pursuing that? You have any thoughts on what Canada should be doing to advance its interests at the intersection between trade and e-commerce?
Well, the first thing we could do is basically get our house in order. That would be the first step. I mean, we have a number of bills still in Parliament. There is a risk, especially when it comes to privacy protection, where our laws are clearly outdated, and this government has twice tried to modernize them. There's and still it hasn't been done. There's a risk that if there's a vote of non-confidence in the House, those bills would just fall apart, and then we'd have to restart the whole process. So I think first of all, that's the first step is where does Canada stand with respect to its own regulations. The other, you mentioned the Digital Economy Partnership Agreement that involves New Zealand, Singapore, and Chile, and now, if I'm not mistaken, also I think South Korea has been accepted as a member. Canada's applied to join that. So this agreement is a much more comprehensive sort of digital economy as opposed to just digital trade. But again, it uses a lot of, when it comes to the digital trade provisions, it uses a lot of the language that we find, either in the USMCA or CUSMA or TPP, and then it adds other things, but it's very much an agreement about regulatory cooperation. Again, it's kind of where the members endeavor to exchange information, to discuss, and maybe eventually, try to kind of have greater harmonization of their rules and regulations and standards. But it's still very early stage. So again, we haven't seen a lot of concrete actions coming out of these broader, more comprehensive digital economy partnership agreements that involve mostly smaller countries. Canada has applied. We're still negotiating Canada's involvement. So we'll really have to see what's going to come out of that. But right now, Canada has not had any strong position when it comes to these international agreements. As I said, it has had a tendency to pretty much follow the Americans on these international agreements much more than having its own position in arguing for a certain approach.
Okay. Well, some would say that that's not atypical on a number of different issues, but I'll leave that for, I suppose, another podcast. Patrick, people don't pay close attention to these issues, but quite clearly, we're seeing the prospect of global frameworks and a consensus beginning to emerge. And so I think needs some real attention. And so thank you for joining me on the podcast to break it down and explain where things stand right now.
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me on the podcast. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca. Or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.